I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE as we get towards the end of a tragic 2025, darkened by the shadow of NATO nation elite power. This elite power, wielded in the Gaza genocide and the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, has not represented what the people of Western Europe want. But throughout history, brotherhoods, cabals, and secret societies have operated beneath the surface of formal politics, bringing together figures from finance, government, and the media. Interrupted by the power of the people, they have shaped pathways to murder and exploitation behind closed doors. Today, these networks persist in the form of gatherings like the Bilderberg meetings, where future and current presidents and senior NATO figures meet off the record. These are figures who would go on to lead institutions central to escalating US-UK-EU militarism, proxy wars, and economic coercion around the globe. Today's guest has spent decades studying these hidden continuities of power. Richard B. Spence is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Idaho. His books include Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence and the Occult, and Trust No One, The Secret World of Sidney Reilly. He joins me now from Moscow. No, not that one. Moscow in the United States, in the state of Idaho. Richard, thank you so much for coming on Going Underground. You spent decades, as I said, studying secret societies. It's, of course, in the interests of the powerful for people not to study or investigate them. So can you first define a secret society, in our case, in the context of political change?
Well, maybe one of the first things to understand about a secret society is that it's not secret in the sense that no one knows about it. So you just mentioned Bilderberg, Bohemian Grove would be another. Certainly, Freemasonry is a kind of generally franchised secret society. Those names are familiar to people. You may not know what they do or who's a member of them, but their existence isn't secret. So what's generally secret in a secret society is what goes on within it. Who belongs, what they discuss, what they do. That's the thing you will find that is never becomes a topic of discussion. So there's a certain sort of criterion. If you're trying to figure out, am I in a secret society? Well, you might look for these signs. First of all, were you selected to be a member? That is, you were chosen. This is an important part. You are chosen for membership on some criteria that the organization has. That also would probably be secret. You have to be vetted before you get in. They don't take just everybody. They tend to be picky. Next, once you get in, you have to go through some sort of initiation, some sort of, you know, in a corporation, you call it onboarding, I suppose. But in the secret society, these initiations can be very simple or they can be very ritualistic and complex. And then, usually as part of the initiations, you have to swear oaths of loyalty and especially secrecy. The one thing in almost every case that you are told over and over again once you have been accepted as a member is that you never talk about what goes on within the organization.
And that's plus, exactly what they do. And I'm going to go through just a few. We're going to race through some of these examples. Sure. I want to get to Bilderberg and Trilateral Commission and, of course, the Epstein Island Secret Society in a second. But you mentioned the Bohemian Club. Just explain that one. Because obviously the U.S. Empire extended massively during the Nixon administration. So just to connect it up to how important and world historical these secret societies can be, it seems the Bohemian one was apt.
Well, the Bohemian Club, one, has nothing actually to do with Bohemia in the physical place. And it's often confused in the public mind with a place where it meets, Bohemian Grove. So people generally talk about Bohemian Grove. These rich guys are having rituals at Bohemian Grove.
In California.
That is their... That's in California. That's their rural meeting area. But that's not the organization. The organization is the Bohemian Club, and its headquarters is in San Francisco. It was founded in the 1870s, largely by a small group of journalists, artists, and musicians. You know, fairly harmless people. But over time, it became fashionable, and it became taken over by corporate businessmen and politicians. gradually the membership changed. And interestingly, as the membership changed, the organization became increasingly secretive. Now, the thing about the Bohemian Club is that it currently has somewhere, it's estimated, around 2,500 active members. There's a long membership list to get in. You must be chosen. It also supposedly costs you $25,000 and an initiation fee. And you know why that's there? To keep out the riffraff. Okay, these things are usually expensive. There's a reason why ordinary people don't get in, usually because you couldn't afford it. So it consists of, first of all, it's an all-male organization. And its members include, well, people in politics, in business, in the media, wealthy and powerful men. So here's the interesting thing. If you're already rich and powerful, this is often the question, what more do you want? What is it that you can't already afford with more money? And you know, how well can you eat, as someone put it? Well, you can have enough money. Arguably, for some people, you can never have enough power or enough influence, because that involves ego. It involves the perception of self. And so since you have now been chosen to be part of an elite organization, well, there's no better ego stroke in the world, is there? You have been chosen to be among the high and the mighty. Now, as the Bohemian Club would put it, what do they get together and do? What are all of their rituals and their summer camp?
We're going to have to speed it along, see how on earth
it's just a person
from a poor background like Richard Nixon became a member.
Yes. Well, in 1967, Richard Nixon was trying to reboot his political career, and he was invited to give a talk, a thing called a Lakeside Talk, at Bohemian Grove to members of the Bohemian Club. He knew this was important. And Nixon, who, keep in mind, was an experienced politician, his view was that I was being auditioned for the presidency. And the whole point was whether I was going to go there and impress these people and they would support my presidential campaign. And they did. And the rest is history.
And then there was Reagan. Then there was Bush. And let's get to the Bilderberg group then. I mean, no announcement yet of 2026's meeting. The last one was in Sweden in 2025. Nearly all the NATO Secretary Generals, Emmanuel Macron, von der Leyen of the European Union, there's Angela Merkel, Hillary Clinton, Tony Blair, Cameron from Britain, Mark Carney, now Canadian Prime Minister, Kissinger. Tell us how we can all join the Bilderberg group and tell them all to stop creating wars.
Well, first of all, you'd have to be an important figure either in politics, business, or finance in the Western world.
But I should add, Professor, that it is before they become successful, some of these. A bit like your Nixon.
Again, the Bilderberg, we know the name, but let me give you an example. What does that name actually mean? It means nothing. Because the Bilderberg Group, the name is simply taken from the first hotel where they met in 1954. So that means that that's not actually the name of the organization. Because, you know, it's like if you had met at Motel 6, you would call them the Motel 6 Group. So there's no actual name. The name is simply taken from the first place they met, and they tend to meet at different fancy venues each year. About 100 to 150 people are invited to attend. Some of those are people who then go on to, you know, they didn't have political office, they do later. Therefore, the argument, the theory is that people are, again, vetted for political roles or public office. But here's the interesting thing, sort of cut to the chase in the Bilderberg group. What do they actually do? Well, you don't know because you're sworn to secrecy. Even if you're a journalist, you are ahead of time told you can never talk about what we discuss here. So there's some reason the public isn't supposed to know that, even though they're sure that whatever we're doing is entirely harmless. But what you named were people who have attended Bilderberg meetings who are public, generally political personalities. They're people who hold some kind of public positions. That's what's seen, and that's what can then be inspected. So let's think of it this way. If you're a member of, if you're a government minister, your work as a government minister is open to some degree to public scrutiny. But if you were then part of a private organization, that's not. So one of these things that these groups do is that they allow people who are otherwise in the public eye to meet in a circumstance where they become, in effect, invisible, where they're no longer, they're still discussing public policy, but they're doing so in a completely private, secret environment.
And Donald Trump isn't a member, of course.
He seems to be an outlier in this case, in so many different ways.
Which is why they hate him, perhaps.
It might have something to do with it.
Trilateral commission. Trilateral commission is something that I have actually interviewed Gore Vidal about it. In his later years, he spoke often about it. Sir Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, is a member. Larry Summers, who just resigned over the Epstein scandal from Harvard, is a member. How does that fit into imperialism, actually, let alone the high membership costs that may be there? And Brzezinski, of course, was a member.
Well, the Trilateral Commission is, first of all, it's fairly recent. It only came into being in 1973, I think is when it was founded. The key figure in it is a fellow who shows up as a key figure in a lot of internationalist organizations, David Rockefeller. So in many ways, it's almost his personal creation. But the Trilateral Commission, most importantly, is an extension or broadening of another organization, the Council on Foreign Relations. Council on Foreign Relations goes back to the early 1920s. And the CFR, like the Bilderbergers would be another example, they're largely what we would call Atlanticist organizations. The whole goal was on keeping the United States and Western Europe bound together in various ways. But what the Trilateral Commission did is that it extended this to East Asia, particularly to Japan. And therefore, the Trilateral Commission has three international headquarters, Washington, D.C., Paris, and Tokyo.
Professor Richard Spence, I'll stop you there. More from the Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Idaho after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Idaho, Professor Richard Spence. Professor, end of part one, we were just finishing up talking, touching the elements of the Bilderberg Group and the Trilateral Commission. You said they were Atlanticist. One can imagine, perhaps, that they want to further the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, despite those who want peace. All we have is speculation, because people can't, as you said, record what's going on. They can't speak about it. It's profoundly anti-democratic, the idea of these secret societies talking about public policy that affects millions of people and millions of lives. What would you speculate as to the Atlanticist nature of their views as regards, say, the war in Europe?
Take the term Atlanticist. One of the things that that clearly excludes is the East. And that would include, see, this is an interesting point. Geographically, Russia, or at least European Russia, is a part of Europe, one would assume. And yet, historically, it's never really been regarded that way. There's a very long-standing tension in between the European East and West, and that European East is generally represented by, you can call it the Russian Empire, the USSR, the Russian Federation today, but there's always been this kind of tension between the two. And this is, I would admit, I don't think I'm alone in this, any kind of historical theory, but I think this goes back not just years, not just decades, but it goes back centuries. It goes back, I'd argue, even to the Middle Ages, where around, I think it was in 1054, the Western and Eastern branches of Christianity, the Orthodox and Roman Catholic Church, split. They essentially excommunicated each other. And two different sort of cultural spheres were created. You'd also notice this tendency over time for these tensions to flare up. Let's take an example just of the two most prominent military demagogues in modern history, at least in Western history, Napoleon Bonaparte and Adolf Hitler. What was the signature move of both of those men? What was supposed to cap their conquest to dominate the world, or at least the European world, the invasion and conquest of Russia? And in both their cases, that was their downfall. It's just, you know, if you consolidate the control of Western Europe, the next thing you do is you marshal your armies and you march east.
And at the secret societies, so these kinds of, it's not quite ancient, but yeah, since 1054, ideas inhabit these secret societies, regardless of what geopolitical experts might say about the effectiveness of Zelensky's troops.
Ideas, unlike people, can live forever, or they can live very, very long time. So they can be passed from one person, from one generation, from one century to another. The same thing with organizations. The reason why you form, whether it's a secret society or any kind of organization, is that that organization can be, so long as there are people to carry it on, it can effectively become immortal. It can continue to institute or to pursue an idea across time. That's one of our human limitations. We don't last that long. There's only, you know, if you push it to the maximum, you can get about 100 years out of it. But an order, secret society, that can last centuries, millennia, and it can continue to pursue particular goals. It's almost as if to me, and I know this may sound fantastic to some people, is that there has been this centuries-long effort to, in some way, reunite the Roman Empire. Because if you tend to look in the kind of Western or European mentality, the Roman Empire is sort of the beginning of everything. I mean, even though it didn't actually work out that well.
The White House has Roman architecture, I think.
Look, you know, anybody wants to have an important building. In the town I live in Moscow, Idaho, if you want to make your building look important, what do? You put columns in front of it because you try to make it look like some sort of Greco-Roman architecture, because that becomes our whole sort of symbol of what important is, this kind of continuity that buildings should look like Roman buildings because the Romans are our model for this. And this struggle between East and West is in a way, is to sort of recombine this, to go back to this single, what is believed, which it probably never really, really was, this kind of universal order that the Roman Empire and the Roman idea represented.
Professor, can I just say that, I mean, if people think this is getting esoteric, this might be the explanation. We have had so many geopolitical analysts who don't understand European policy vis-a-vis the war in Europe, seeing it as almost suicidal for Germany, France, and Britain. But there's some atavistic reason which is trumping everything else, which helps us to understand their policy, how they can give billions to a corrupt Ukraine because of these kinds of reasons, you believe.
I suspect it. Belief is a tricky word. And to me, when you believe something, you begin to take that as the truth and act on it. I suspect that there are, as you mentioned, these kind of atavistic ideas. You know, we talked today about memes, the concept of an infectious idea, an idea that will sort of penetrate a person's mind to begin to influence them even without them being aware of it. And that goes on all the time. I mean, yeah, that's the key to advertising, isn't it? To make you want something that you never knew that you wanted. So I think that history is driven by deep-seated, in many ways, kind of psychological memes that exist within cultures, that exist within society, that are carried on as one person put it, that people drink these things with their mother's milk. They're not even aware that they have them, but they continue to be influenced by them.
But should I just say, I mean, in all of your work, if you put too much importance on that powerful force in history, you sometimes miss the interruptions, which are the power of the people themselves. Arguably, Trump won on the power of the people against these sort of atavistic ideas, which is why so many amongst the Bilderberg and Trilateral are presumably appalled by him.
Well, he's not a member of their club. They didn't invite him. And they have very particular ideas as to who should belong to this type of thing. I mean, the very concept of what is roughly the term elites, and secret societies are often connected to elites. That term is probably somewhat overused. But there are people who do indeed that believe that either because of, well, if you're a royal, you believe that you were born into it. Some people believe that they went to the right university and therefore they're part of it. Other people believe that it's who they know that makes them a part of it. But the other thing that secret societies do is they tend to take people who already think they're special and make them more special, which give them a sense.
Some would call it class. You're a scholar of the Russian Revolution. You'd recognize that. Well, okay. Let's just finally quickly get to, you know, Epstein file redactions will face intense scrutiny. That's obviously a newspaper headline ahead of the inevitable redactions that we'll expect for a different secret society, the Epstein secret society. What do you make of the power of that secret society? Marjorie Taylor Greene saying that she spoke to Trump and Trump was so sensitive about the membership of the Epstein Secret Society, so sensitive he would give up on support from a cheerleader in Congress for him, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, even as she was talking about the rape of 14-year-olds. And not that I'm saying that Trump is in any way involved in those particular crimes, but of course he's mentioned in the files themselves. We had an Israeli agent, former person who worked in the Israeli Secret Services as a translator, who said they had something on him. How is that different, the secret society, to these other societies?
Well, if you look at Epstein's operation, what it looks like to me is that it's a criminal operation on a number of different levels. Epstein is an interesting case because where does he come from? Well, he doesn't come from a wealthy family. He doesn't come from influential family. He was a Long Island kid who was good at math. And I think one of the best explanations I ever heard of how he got started was that he was a kind of smart, nerdy kid who made friends by doing their math homework, right? You're not popular because you're a jock. You're not popular for necessarily because you're that good looking or you dance well. You're popular because you can do other people's math homework and get them to pass.
Coney Island.
His whole career is ingratiating himself to wealthy, powerful people. What did he do as a financial advisor? Look at it. Just stand back and look at what he did. And what he did was that he helped them dodge taxes. You know, tax mitigation strategies, it's called tax dodging. He also helped them hide money. You know, he could help people discover money that had been hidden abroad. He could help them hide money. If you do one, you can do the other. And that's how he moved as a kind of fixer and arranger into the realm of the rich and powerful. And in that process, either he or other people who were working with him found out that these people can be compromised in a number of ways. And so then you start installing cameras in your residences, in the bedrooms, in the bathrooms. And there's only one reason you do that. I mean, it's fairly simple. The only reason why you collect all of this video information on your rich and powerful friends is to potentially use it as leverage against them. You don't have to actually use it. You simply have to make them aware that you have it and could use it.
And you suspected. So I think you've appeared to suspect. Sorry to interrupt there. We're just coming to an end. You suspected that he was killed. I don't know what you think about Charlie Kirk, that was a big assassination of 2025, emotionally disturbed lone gunman. I don't know what threats you think that could be, what threats you expect against Trump, because he's not a member of these other clubs. Is assassination, is killing also part, the ultimate part of a secret society?
I mean, first of all, Donald Trump is a president of the United States, which puts a target on you to begin with. That's, you know, there they have been shot before. And unfortunately, that will probably arise again. So there's the inherent danger simply being a prominent and polarizing public figure. And then add to that, that Trump seems, for better or for worse, to go out and often deliberately antagonize many of these existing power groups. And he shakes things up. And I'm not going to argue that he does that, that this is part of his, you know, three-dimensional chess, whatever that may be, or simply because he's erratic. You know, this is often the question. I ask this myself, you know, is there a method to this madness? Or is it simply erratic? I don't know. And that's politics. And I'm not going to get in. I'm just going to talk about dead people. That's where I'm most comfortable talking about. Because they can't sue you. So Trump has a big target on him, and I think larger than most presidents would have. In some ways, I think that every day he survives is a kind of blessing, in a way. He has probably one of the most dangerous positions in the world. In terms of Epstein, did Epstein kill himself or was he killed? Well, the important point here is that he's conveniently dead. That's the point. He will never go on trial. He will never be questioned. He can never be subjected to any kind of interrogation. So whether he killed himself or whether he was killed, the important point is that he was eliminated. And he had a great deal of information that could, and he was someone who was in the business, I think. I mean, the only business I see is that he was in the business of compromising people. Now, the other question about Epstein, was he doing this all on his own? You know, did he just think of this whole thing, install the cameras, collect the information, keep the tapes in order? Was this just all his idea, or is he a tool of something greater?
Professor Richard Spence, have to, on that note, off suspense, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide across Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Remember, we're bringing you brand new episodes every Saturday and Monday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you soon.